The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So we talk a lot about mindfulness here, and I thought I would just explore that theme a bit tonight. What does it mean to be mindful, and why is it helpful, and how we might establish what could be called wise mindfulness? You know, mindfulness itself is, at least I think of mindfulness, or a bare definition perhaps of mindfulness, or a simple definition of mindfulness, is just this capacity of our minds to know what's happening while it's happening. It's like this self-reflective capacity of our minds. It's a natural human capacity. It's, you know, it's not anything esoteric. It's just this simple capacity that we have as human beings to know that we know, to be aware that we're aware. To me, that's that quality of mindfulness. And, you know, mindfulness in a way is it's a function of our minds that's useful as a tool. And it can be used for many things. You know, that tool of being aware in the present moment can be used to help us accomplish a particular activity, or it could be used by a thief to be very alert while walking through a house to steal something. And so, you know, in and of itself, I think of mindfulness as a kind of a neutral tool. Like many tools, tools can be used for to help us or to harm us. And the question then is, how do we apply mindfulness? How do we use mindfulness in a skillful way? And what's the kind of direction of mindfulness for our practice, for our meditation practice? First, I'll just talk a little bit about, you know, how we explore the quality of mindfulness in meditation practice. I mean, it is a natural quality of mind, but it's not one that we typically, if it's not pointed out to us as being a kind of a special quality of mind, most of us aren't likely to think of it as a special quality of mind. Because it's so ordinary, you know, because it just kind of happens now and then. I think it was kind of an amazing thing that the Buddha recognized this particular quality and said, if we use this quality of mind, this aspect of our minds in a particular way, it really serves us. And so we explore cultivating what it means to be mindful. We explore recognizing what it means to be mindful. We kind of begin to establish our ability to stay present, to know what's happening in the present moment while it's happening for longer stretches of time. And this is the practice. We do this in our sitting practice. We explore perhaps staying with the breath, just cultivating that capacity to be with in and out breaths, noticing when the mind wanders, coming back to the breath, getting familiar with what it means to stay present in the present moment. And, you know, that same capacity, as we begin to get familiar with that, we begin to see that, you know, it's not that the tool of mindfulness is not just about staying with the breath. I mean, the breath is a kind of a way in which we can learn what it means to have that continuity of mindfulness. But the that quality of mindfulness itself is what we're more interested in a way, and how we use that quality of mindfulness. In our practice, we orient that quality of mindfulness, I think, in some different ways, but we can quickly see, even with just something as simple as turning our attention to the breath, we can quickly see that, you know, that simple activity helps us calm down, you know, makes us feel a little more settled, a little more easeful in our minds. You know, just this activity of, say, letting go of our thoughts and returning to the breath over and over again, we feel a sense of ease or a sense of relaxation at times. And so we see the benefit that this mindfulness has for us. So that's one of the ways we can use this tool, just in a very simple way to calm our minds down. And yet that the power of mindfulness in the way the Buddha explored it, I mean, he basically, his journey was motivated by a question of, you know, why do we suffer so much? You know, it's like we go through our lives doing things, acting in ways that we hope to find happiness and ease in our lives, and yet we still suffer. You know, we still find ourselves caught and angry and confused and struggling and frustrated when something we want doesn't happen. And all of those states of mind, this is part of what the Buddha was pointing to when he was exploring, why do we suffer? You know, is it possible to be free of these reactive tendencies of mind and have a sense of ease or peace in our lives? Not a sense of ease or peace that necessarily means you're just kind of sitting there floating on a cloud, but a sense of ease or peace in engagement, a sense of ease or peace in activity in the world. Is it possible? Might that be possible? And so his quest towards freedom from reactivity, freedom from struggle, freedom from stress, motivated his search. And so the tool of mindfulness, when he discovered the tool of mindfulness and applied it to that question, this is one of the ways that freedom began to appear to him. He began to recognize that this tool of mindfulness, when directed to that question of why does the mind suffer? And this tool of mindfulness means actually looking in the present moment. You know what mindfulness is. You notice what's happening while it's happening. And so he began, perhaps in his practice, you know, I expect there was some of this happening in his practice, that he began exploring, oh, there's suffering happening right now. What's this about right now? Or there's ease and peace happening right now. What's that about? So bringing that tool of mindfulness to investigate his own experience. When is there suffering? What conditions lead to suffering? When is there ease and peace? And what conditions lead in that direction? And so he began using this simple quality of mind, of knowing what's happening in the present moment, to begin to explore that question. He wasn't using it to explore how could he be so still that he could walk through a village without anybody knowing he was there, or, you know, some other, maybe sometimes in his day there were special powers of mind that came through really concentrating the mind, that a lot of yogis were cultivating the capacity of concentration to refine those capacities of mind to hear things at a very far distance, or, you know, just things like that, you know, so this tool of mindfulness can be used to cultivate a concentration that leads to you know, certain kinds of very powerful capacities in the mind. And yet that wasn't what he found he wanted to do with that quality. He wanted to understand this question of suffering. And so this is where the tool of mindfulness, that how he ended up freeing his mind from suffering, from this reactive states of mind, and then teaching. And so the way that he taught, what he taught about this path of practice that he explored, is all oriented around this question of how might we be happy? Happy in a deep sense, not happy in dependence on getting what I want or getting rid of what I don't want, but happy in the sense of able to be at peace with whatever the conditions are, able to be responsive rather than reactive to conditions, able to navigate the world with an open heart of compassion and love and wisdom rather than anger and hatred and aversion, or desire and confusion. And so this peace that he's pointing us to isn't the peace of non-action, but it's the peace of action through wisdom and action through compassion, an action without a contracted heart, the contracted heart really being where that suffering is experienced. And so this tool of mindfulness, how to cultivate this tool so that we can begin to understand our minds, our experience. So we start with this simple cultivation, perhaps, of getting familiar with what it even means to be present with something like the breath. But as we, as that strengthens, as that ability, that capacity to stay with experience over a period of time strengthens through being with the breath, we might begin to be interested in more experience. Like, how are our thoughts right now, and how are our emotions contributing? Like, even as we breathe, you know, even as the mind is connected with the experience of breathing, there's other things going on in the present moment. If you're noticing the breath, you might be noticing how thoughts pull you away, or you might be noticing some boredom arising around the breath and feeling the mind get contracted around boredom. Or you might be noticing, if you're able to stay with the breath for longer periods of time, that the mind gets more comfortable, and that actually the body gets more comfortable, that there's less of a sense of jitteriness and agitation. And so we start to notice broader experience with this quality of mindfulness. And ultimately, I think that some of the power of mindfulness begins to reveal itself as mindfulness strengthens and can open to a broader range of experience. Not simply stay with one thing, but begin to see how various processes in our mind interact with each other. You know, we might begin to see, and we can begin to see as we pay attention with mindfulness, that a thought, a memory, for instance, of arguing with somebody yesterday arises in our mind. And based on the arising, I mean, you're sitting here minding your own business in meditation, paying attention to the breath, and this thought comes through. This thought is not random. There's maybe something in your experience that has triggered that thought. Maybe a feeling in the body or a contraction in the body or something triggered that thought. We don't always know what that was. But if you see that thought, you might recognize, oh, that argument with somebody. And then feel into how that thought then impacts the experience here and now. We're paying attention to the breath. A thought arises and suddenly we're flooded with an emotion. We see very directly in the present moment the creation of contraction, the creation of struggle. And so we can explore what it might mean to let go of that thought. See if we can touch into the feelings that have arisen and see maybe the breath again will allow that to settle. So we begin to recognize the interplay between various aspects of our mind and body. We see how they condition each other. We see that the thought arising conditions an emotion arising. An emotion arising conditions contractions in the body. So there's all of this interplay between body and mind. And that interplay is some of where suffering, reactivity begins to slip in. And so seeing this, learning about this with mindfulness, we begin to... The mind begins to understand something. The mind begins to understand. One of the things it begins to understand really clearly, and this was so interesting to me when I first started practicing, you know, it's like, it became pretty clear to me when I first started practicing, because I was using anger as a tool to explore my mind a lot in the first few months of my practice. That was a doorway in for me to explore that reactive pattern of mind. So just waking up to be present when anger happened. And one of the things that I began to recognize, one of the first things I noticed was, wow, this doesn't feel very good. You know, anger hurts. It's suffering. And over the course of a few weeks of this, I began to see I had missed that entirely. I began to see that the mind, when it was caught in the story of anger, somehow had the belief that this anger was going to hurt the other person. You know, the anger, this anger was going to make the other person miserable. And in the meantime, because I was so caught in that story and caught in that belief, I had no clue that it was actually hurting me first. The Buddha talks about, or there's a, maybe it's not in the Buddha's words, but in the commentaries, a story around how anger works in our minds. You know, it's they say it's like picking up a hot coal to throw at somebody. You burn yourself first. But we're so focused on trying to, you know, hurt the other person, we totally miss that we're being burned. And so this simple tool of noticing what's happening in the present moment, bringing mindfulness to the experience, begins to, it's a simple lesson, actually, a really simple lesson. Reactivity hurts. Reactivity is suffering. And that simple lesson begins to instruct the mind, give the mind an education that, you know, that belief that this reactivity is going to make somebody else miserable, or this reactivity is going to somehow get what I want. In the meantime, we are giving up peace here and now for some idea of something that we either might get or something that might happen to somebody else. We are giving it up here and now. And the mind begins to see that directly in the moment and starts to, in ways, figure out how to readjust, shift, and let go of some of those reactive patterns. And so simply beginning to establish mindfulness with this question of exploring suffering in our experience. This begins to point the mind in the direction of understanding. The Buddha taught about suffering. You know, he framed his whole teaching in terms of suffering. He said that suffering should be understood experientially, not through, you know, reflecting about, well, why am I suffering now? Oh, because I was like, you know, I know that when I was a kid, all these kids used to beat me up on the playground or whatever, and so I really have defensiveness and have to fight back, and this is why I'm so unhappy and so miserable. I'm always fighting people. That kind of thinking can be useful at times, but that's not the understanding the Buddha was pointing to. What he was pointing to was this use of the tool of mindfulness to understand in the moment, oh, this is suffering happening in the moment. This is how suffering is put together in the moment. This thought arising and this clamping down, or this thought arising leading to a kind of a whole chain of emotional storms that follow because of that thought. So we see the cause and effect relationships. And the mind begins to understand something of its own contribution to our reactivity. That understanding itself begins to lead the way towards the letting go. The letting go that can happen, the letting go of reactivity that can happen through this process of simply watching. Now, there are definitely times when we turn our mindful attention to some kind of reactivity, when we begin to explore suffering. And, you know, this doesn't take very long. You know, we sit down in meditation and, you know, simple sufferings work really well for exploring this kind of thing in our practice. You know, you're sitting in meditation and you're paying attention to the breath, and you think of something else you want to be doing, or something else that, you know, it's like, oh, I don't want to be sitting here. This is boring. Right there, there's suffering. Right there. Oh, boredom is arising. What might it mean, instead of giving into that boredom and, say, getting up and forgetting the meditation, to say, oh, boredom is happening, and feel into the boredom and how there's a kind of dissatisfying quality in the heart there, a feeling of dissatisfaction, a feeling of wanting something else, something more interesting to be happening. Right there, that can be explored, investigated with mindfulness. Little sufferings You know, it's so interesting the way suffering works in our minds. The little sufferings are put together in exactly the same way that the bigger sufferings are. And so when we start to explore the little sufferings, we learn something about how our minds work, and that gives us some of the tools to support actually meeting and working with the bigger sufferings. And yet the bigger sufferings, you know, those big storms of anger or feelings of self-righteousness when, you know, somebody is really, you feel like somebody has done you wrong, or strong feelings of craving for something. Those patterns too we can work with mindfulness. And yet at times those patterns can be stronger than our capacity to be mindful for them. It's like, you know, like me, that first pattern of anger, you know, when I first started working with anger, about all I could do was go like, well, yeah, I'm angry. I don't know what I do with this. It's like trying to be mindful of it was not so easy. And so, you know, I just kind of say, okay, well, I guess I go on to, you know, the rest of my day. I'll just, you know, put my attention in something else. So there are times when it's helpful to, if you try or if you're exploring being mindful of some strong pattern of reactivity, and you find that the mindfulness just gets swamped by the reactivity, you just go down the rabbit hole, it can be really helpful to just simply acknowledge, yeah, there's that reactivity and there's that rabbit hole, and this isn't the time to try to be mindful of it because I'm likely to just get pulled down that rabbit hole. So finding some other strategies, not non-mindful strategies. Often I find, you know, people may want to distract themselves, like turn on the television or browse on the internet or something. But if you've got a habit of mind that's going, a reactive pattern, and you put yourself into a distracted space where you're taking in things from television or the internet, it's pretty likely, given the way these patterns work, you know, these patterns like connect to so many different other things in our lives, that if you're not being mindful and you know, if you decide, I'm just going to distract myself, I'm going to watch TV or, you know, whatever, just do some Google searching, the likelihood is that that something will enter in from that door that hooks back to that reactive pattern, and you'll just find yourself looped back into it. And so really helpful to distract yourself mindfully. So you're welcome to say, okay, I'm not going to pay attention to that. I'm going to put my attention in something else. I'm going to be mindful of something else. Maybe be mindful of hearing right now, or be mindful of something simple like feet on the ground, you know, something just really simple. Sometimes something like music can be helpful if it's a really strong pattern, if it's a non-wordy music, or it's not a kind of music that tends to trigger certain kinds of emotions. I mean, some music really can hook us right back into reactive patterns depending on what the music is. But, you know, just finding some way or place to shift the mindful attention. This is like what we could call skillful ignoring. You know, we just stop paying attention to that thing and put our attention someplace else. And if we find our attention drawn back, it's just like, oh, yep, I see you. Not now. I'm going to just put my attention over here. Really helpful to do that with a non-reactive mind, not averse, not trying to bury it or repress it. It's almost like saying to that pattern, you can sit in the room with me, but I'm going to pay attention to this right now. So this allows the mind to keep cultivating the capacity to be present, to keep cultivating that quality of knowing what's happening in the present moment while it's happening, but not being stuck to something that kind of is a quicksand for the mindfulness. So this is a little bit about mindfulness and why it's helpful, and you know, the tools for cultivating mindfulness. Really, it's so helpful to begin to simply recognize what it means to be mindful. What is the experience of mindfulness itself? So often when we practice mindfulness, we're working with a particular experience, like the breath, you know, paying attention to the breath, for example. Well, there's that directing of the attention. We choose to pick something to pay attention to. And mindfulness can get cultivated through that directing of the attention. And yet if we think that being mindful means always directing the attention, we're not quite understanding the power and the capacity of the simple function of mindfulness itself, to just be aware of whatever's happening in the present moment while it's happening. It's not necessary to direct the attention in order to be mindful. And right now, maybe, you know, what's most obvious for you? Maybe seeing? Maybe the experience of hearing? You know, right now, how hard is it to be aware? Can you know that seeing is happening? Can you know that hearing is happening? Know that body sensations are happening? Right now, I'm directing the attention for you. Can you know the sensations of your hands right now? Can you know the sensations of your hips touching the chair or cushion or bench? You know, it's not very hard to be mindful in a moment of a variety of experiences. And over time, we can begin to recognize that we can kind of settle back and be receptive. You know, like putting your attention to hearing right now, just taking in the sounds. Not a lot of sounds right now. The sound of my voice. A couple sounds outside. Just relax. There's a sense of the receptive quality to hearing. That we don't have to, like, think I'm going to pay attention to the hum of the audio system. Or you don't have to think, I'm going to pay attention to the sound of my voice. It's very natural. It just happens. It's just so this quality of mindfulness is a very simple quality of just knowing what's happening while it's happening. We don't have to direct the attention in order for mindfulness to be present. When we begin to get familiar with the experience of mindfulness itself, what it means to be aware, and we can do this by cultivating that directed attention. Another way to do this is by beginning to recognize the moment when mindfulness returns. Now, this is a great moment. It's a fantastic moment, actually, and it happens a lot. You know, in sitting meditation, it happens, in 45-minute sitting or a 30-minute sitting, maybe, you know, it happens 50 times or maybe 20 times if you're really able to stay present in that 30 minutes, you know. Or maybe it happens only a few times if you wander for a very long time. But in any case, it will happen. That moment when mindfulness returns, it will happen. And in that moment, mindfulness arises, and you remember, you recognize, oh, I'm back. And in that moment, mindfulness is aware of something. You know, sometimes mindfulness can re-arise because a loud car goes by, and whoo, the mindfulness comes back. It's noticing the sound of the car. Or sometimes mindfulness can re-arise just kind of spontaneously. It's just, you know, we wake up in the midst of a thought. So right there, in that moment when mindfulness returns, we're not choosing what to pay attention to. Mindfulness has arisen, and it's knowing something. One of the great exercises or great explorations in that moment is to just begin to be curious. What does it mean? What's the difference between mindfulness here now and mindfulness not here a moment ago? In the moment when mindfulness returns, there is a kind of a lingering memory of what it was like for the mind to be lost a few moments ago. And so it kind of highlights the quality of mindfulness here and now. What does it mean to be awake right now? So that's one reason that moment is so helpful, because it begins to really point out the experience or the quality of mindfulness itself. What does it mean to be aware in the present moment? The other great thing about that moment is that you didn't have to do it. You didn't have to do any work for that moment of mindfulness. It just happened. And so again, it points out the possibility of a light touch or an effortless quality to mindfulness. So getting familiar with that moment of mindfulness returning does those two things. It helps us recognize the quality of mindfulness and recognize what it means to be mindful without working so hard to do it. I think this is one way that we get frustrated in our practice. It is a hard practice. It's hard to keep remembering. Now, the word for mindfulness, the Pali word for mindfulness, sati, the root of that word actually means remember. So that's our work with mindfulness, is remembering it. And one of the ways to support the remembering is to begin to recognize it when it returns. Once it's returned, once mindfulness is here, we can then kind of prompt some mindfulness. We can, okay, I'm mindful now, and maybe now it's a good idea to go back to the breath. Or maybe now all I need to do is just, notice the tension that's arisen, having been wandering, and relax again, connect to the process of relaxation, and then notice hearing happening, and then notice body sensation. So we can connect to mindfulness and this process of being awake, either through choosing to direct the attention, or by settling back and just simply kind of knowing, being aware of this flow of experience that is our human life. So we get familiar, if you can get familiar with this experience of mindfulness itself, it really serves you, because the recognition of that moment, the recognition of what it means to be mindful, actually begins to help us see that it happens a lot. You know, it happens way more than we think it does, especially in our daily lives. That simple practice of notice mindfulness returning is my key daily life practice. And not even necessarily trying to sustain it in daily life, but just recognize, there it is. Mindfulness has returned. What's that like? Getting familiar with it. And as we get familiar with that experience itself, what seems to happen is that the attunement we get sensitized to it, so we start to recognize it more. We see it happening more and more. And then we just begin to get more and more moments of very effortless mindfulness through our day. It doesn't take a lot of work to just highlight that moment. It takes a little bit to recognize, to be interested in, this is mindfulness returning. So I just offer that to you, just in terms of beginning to cultivate this tool of mindfulness. And then the other key piece around mindfulness is that, as I said at the beginning, you know, mindfulness is a kind of a neutral tool. And our minds are such that it's really easy for that tool to be co-opted by habits of patterns of mind, of wanting something to be a certain way. You know, we find ourselves sitting in meditation and we're paying attention to the breathing in order to get back to that really good state we had last time. Yeah, so there's some greed going there. Or we're paying attention to some kind of pain in our knee and thinking, the last time I really dove into that pain, it went away. And so again, you know, maybe even an aversion focusing on that experience. So the thing we have to be interested in in addition to cultivating the recognition of mindfulness itself, is to begin to be curious about, you know, what is our motivation, or what is happening, why or how are we meditating? And a simple question about this might be, okay, so there's this experience that is happening. I'm mindful of something. I'm aware of the breath, for example. And what's my relationship to this experience right now? Do I want something else to be happening? Do I want something to stop happening? Am I confused? Or do I believe that something needs something? Do I have a belief about something that needs to happen? So checking in, what else is going on? It's like sometimes when we're being mindful, it's like we're looking at experience from here. You know, it's like I'm just as kind of an analogy. It's like we're just looking in front of us. And this checking into the attitude or the relationship, what's my attitude about what's happening now, or what's my relationship to what's happening now? It kind of steps us back so that we might be able to see something that's hiding, an agenda, a belief, an attitude, an idea that's hiding in the back of our mind that's kind of motivating or creating some kind of relationship of struggle with what's happening. Often I find it really helpful when I'm meditating, if I'm paying attention to something, and there's a sense of struggle in that experience, I check the relationship. It's like, okay, if I'm paying attention to this, and it feels really hard to be paying attention to this. What's the attitude? You know, it could be as simple as, I don't want this to be happening. I wish it were something else. I wish it were that state of peace that were happening a few days ago. You know, so that wanting it not to be happening, that aversion. If that aversion is not recognized, that kind of agenda, ideas, beliefs are not recognized, then we may be unwittingly reinforcing habits, patterns of reactivity, even in our meditation. And so checking in, you know, checking from time to time in our meditation, when there's a kind of an established sense of being able to be with something, from time to time checking in, what's my relationship to what's happening? There's going to be four basic relationships. So you can kind of check in. Is it one of these four? Sometimes when I check in, you know, what's my relationship to what's happening? It's not very obvious. I don't really find an answer. That's okay. If you don't find an answer, you don't have to go looking for it. This question of what's my relationship isn't one to think about. It's not one to try to figure out what your relationship is. It's more kind of to take your sense of what is happening, see if there can be a bigger container, a bigger sense of being aware of something that might be happening that's not noticed. And just seeing what might become obvious. Sometimes when we ask that question, what's my relationship to what's happening, or what's the attitude, or even a question like, what else is going on here? Not to think about it, not to try to figure it out, but just dropping in that question, it's like we were looking in tunnel vision, and now suddenly we have a bigger perspective. And something might be revealed just by asking that question. So we don't have to try to figure it out. And in fact, I would encourage you not to try to figure it out. Just drop in the question and see. Sometimes when you drop in the question, it's like it becomes glaringly obvious. Oh, right. I don't like this. That's what else is going on. And so it gives a bigger container, a bigger perspective on the situation. And in that moment, we begin to see, we become mindful of something we weren't aware of before. A sense of reactivity in the mind, a sense of not liking, of aversion, of greed. And then we just know that too. Allow the process of being aware of what's happening to do its work. So the four basic flavors of attitude, four basic flavors. There's the flavor of wanting something, wanting something to be happening. So flavor of greed, you know, of leaning into experience, of wanting something to continue, of reaching for something pleasant. That's one flavor. Many, many different moods or thoughts might be associated with that. I need, I want. Another flavor, the flavor of aversion, of wanting something to stop happening. Often this happens if there's unpleasant experience being known. If unpleasant experience is happening, often there's a wanting to get rid of it, to fix it, to change it, to control it. So there's, again, many flavors of that aversive attitude. Might just be a sense of needing to fix or control or change. Could be full-out hatred or rage or anger or irritation or frustration. I have a lot of experience with that particular flavor of attitude. So many of those words pop into my mind. I've experienced the subtlest to the most obvious forms of that. The wanting side, the greedy side, my mind is a little more simple about. It's just like, yeah, I want a cookie, or, you know, it's like this mind doesn't have quite the nuanced understanding of greed as it does of aversion. It's spent a lot more time in that side of things. That's been the orientation. Except that I would assume that, you know, on the side of greed, you know, minds have different proclivities or different, maybe even personalities, we could call them, that they tend to orient to the world with. Some minds tend to orient to the world through aversion, you know. This mind definitely did that, you know. I would walk into a space and immediately notice the things that I thought were wrong about it. So just orienting towards what I didn't like about it, and, oh, that needs to be fixed, that needs to be changed. Other minds might walk into a room and, you know, orient to, wow, that's so beautiful, look at that. Oh, that color of green on that exit sign is so amazing. You know, that kind of movement of mind where it orients towards the pleasant. So that some minds have more of that proclivity, other minds have more of the proclivity towards aversion. I think that those people that have more of the proclivity towards the greedy side of things probably have as much refinement of, you know, different kinds of greedy states as I have of aversive states. But I don't have all of the words in my mind to just pop right out. And then there's the third flavor of attitude is that of confusion or delusion. And you know, here as a personality type, this flavor is one of kind of being disconnected, of not really knowing what's happening. So being confused or just spaced out or just kind of in your own world. You know, you might walk, that kind of person might walk into a room and just be, you know, kind of, you know, unaware of what's going on. Be kind of, what am I doing here? Or what's happening here? So those are the three flavors of relationship to experience. You know, you could be paying attention to boredom. You know, boredom might be in that confused area, you know, that area of kind of being disconnected from experience. That typically boredom arises when we're not really meeting experience. So that might be a relationship to experience, you know. So you're paying attention to breath and it's just like struggling. It's like, you know, in, out, in, out, in. And so that feels hard to do it. Check into the relationship. What's going on? Oh, boredom. Boredom is what's happening. Partly because the mind isn't quite really connected, perhaps, to the experience. So different, you know, different relationships. If we can see the boredom, it's like, oh, there's boredom happening. You know, what is the actual experience of boredom? Well, actually, boredom is kind of got this stepped back quality. You know, we can sometimes work with boredom by simply, you know, being a little bit more, even actively curious about something like, well, what's the beginning of the in-breath feel like? Or Or what's the end of the in-breath feel like? Just adding a little bit more interest to the mix. So greed, aversion, delusion, kind of the basic reactive attitudes of mind to experience. The fourth flavor of attitude is what we could call balance of mind. Non-reactivity. This can be experienced in quite a few different ways too. It might be experienced as calm, or ease, or equanimity, or curiosity, or even love, kindness, open-heartedness. So, you know, sometimes when I talk about this attitude aspect of practice, you know, people, you know, hear that word, you know, what's the attitude, and think it means necessarily some problematic relationship. When we check our relationship to experience, sometimes the relationship is one of no problem. What's happening now is just there's no reactivity. The mind feels calm. And sometimes when we check into that relationship and we don't see much of an attitude, you could try on calm. Is it calm that's happening right now? Is it ease that's happening around this relationship right now? Sometimes this non-reactive or balance of mind is subtle. It's not so easy to actually begin to attune to. You know, non-reactivity is something that we can miss easily. So beginning to recognize, you know, sometimes when we check our relationship to experience, beginning to recognize those times when there's not a lot of reactivity begins to help our mindfulness begin to connect with some subtler, beautiful, wholesome states of mind, like equanimity, like love, like ease, like peace, like interest, like confidence, a whole host of beautiful states of mind that begin to get developed as the mindfulness strengthens. And these states of mind begin to directly counter these other three, greed, aversion, delusion, states of mind. So the practice unfolds both by becoming aware of how we're suffering, noticing our relationship, where we might be introducing, kind of old habits of mind into our meditation. As we become aware of that, we can begin to unwind those patterns too and start to touch into the possibility of more peace, more ease in our lives. So, wow, I talked way longer than I thought I would. We have a few minutes if there's any comments or questions about what anything I said or anything else. Yeah, and would you use the mic?
My question is, in the sanctuary here, mindfulness is possibly easier than in the wide open, stimulating world.
Absolutely.
Yeah, with all the distractions.
I think we'll all agree with you there.
And there's a concept within Buddhism, because I'm certainly a novitiate at this point, a newcomer, that I'm intrigued by. It sounds appealing, but I don't know, because it's in the outside world, I don't know how you translate the gentleness and discipline and structure of our sanctuary here into a thing called mindfulness walking meditation. That's where, mm-hmm. that's where I'm trying to go with this. Uh-huh. Is walking meditation. To me, that sounds like the epitome of perfection, to be able to walk through the woods, if you will, aware of your environment, aware of your habitat, but balanced.
Yeah.
So I'm not asking for necessarily a big answer tonight, but maybe as we go on, Andrea, occasionally we can take the lab effect of this, you know, the incubator effect of the sanctuary, and ask how we translate that into, like, let's say, a walking meditation.
Yeah. So the first piece I'll just point to, you know, the one tool I pointed to for daily life today was recognizing the moment when mindfulness returns. In daily life, it actually happens a lot. You know, you're walking across the street and, you know, suddenly you're actually aware that you're walking across the street, or you're having breakfast and you're picking up a glass and suddenly you're aware you're picking up your glass. It's just those moments starting to recognize those moments. So that's one way to begin to move it from the lab of the sitting practice into daily life. And one helpful way to shift that is to get really curious in the lab of sitting meditation. What is that moment of waking up, returning from being lost, like? And then you can start to notice those moments happen in daily life too. While you're walking, while you're in the grocery store, while you're driving, they happen all the time. They happen way more than you are aware of. And so that sensitization to it begins to highlight or point out those moments more and more. And then with walking meditation, I'll give a brief thing for walking meditation in daily life. There's one practice that I enjoy. I'll give you two. One is, you know, when walking, just walk. Just say that to yourself. When walking, just walk. So while you're taking a walk, when walking, just walk. You know, it's like, it's just a simple way to remember, I'm here. So you could just drop that in every few moments. Oh, when walking, just walk. And see if you can let go of thoughts while that's happening. A little more structured approach to walking meditation or walking practice. And again, you know, this would probably be hard to do in the grocery store, but if you are just walking in the neighborhood, an alternation between four areas of experience. This is something I've found really helpful, and I love this practice. So alternate between four areas of experience: seeing, for say 4 or 5 steps. Just know seeing is happening. So take in the field, the visual field. It's almost like, you know, watching, not looking at things, but just, you know, allowing sight to go by for 5 or so steps. And then shift to hearing for 5 or so steps. Just put your attention in the field of hearing. And then for the next 5 or so steps, just the physical sense of walking, just the body moving through space, arms swinging, legs swinging. So just that feeling of body. And then for the last part, the fourth area, is just the contact, the kind of contact of feet on the ground. So alternating between those four areas, seeing. And I remember the order top to bottom: seeing, hearing, moving, touching, body. And I use those labels too, just to help me remember, okay, seeing, seeing, seeing for 5 steps, hearing for 5 steps. And that begins to help you to kind of enter into the experience of being present for kind of a wide range of experience while walking. It starts to open you to that process of being available for a lot of different experiences while walking. And then you can also check into your relationship while that's happening. You know, check into the attitude. It's like, ooh, I like this, or you know, again, this is boring, or whatever. So just, yeah, you can play with that.
Thank you, Andrea. Thank you.
And it's time to stop. So thank you.